You're listening to The Dead Prussian, a podcast about war and warfare.
What are the attributes that make a good professional in any profession? Are their attributes the same as other professionals in different professions or even in the same profession? What about the people who use the services that a professional provides? How do they need to respond to certain attributes? Do they need attributes of their own? I don't have the answers, but I'm going to keep looking for them. G'day listeners, how are you going? It is Mick, your host of the only podcast out there named after a 19th century Prussian military thinker so far. Although I've heard rumours there's a few likely competition podcasts on their way out, but I'm sure they'll be good material, and I'll just steal their guests if I need to. Thank you very much for tuning in to our comeback season. We've had some great hits for the episode on the redefining of the modern military with Pauline Shanks-Curran, and also our episode with Brendan Taylor on how Asia goes to war. Today, we're going to go back to redefining the modern military. That's that book that I was telling you about that Nate Finney and Ty Mayfield have written. It is out now. By the time you're listening to this show, it's not actually out whilst I'm recording, but that's okay. Check it out on Amazon or Book Depository. Thank you very much to all those listeners who participated in our poll as well. We will be switching our book services to Amazon because that's what you all want. You're being American, yous being Australian. That's what yous all want. Yous all. There we go. I've combined two languages together. Now, let's get on to the topic of today. So today we're going to be discussing the attributes that make up a professional. As I said, this is part of that whole redefining the modern military piece that Nate and Ty have been hard at. So I've got a guest today who wrote a chapter in that book all about professional attributes and also the attributes of people who use professionals or are the clients of professionals. Keep your ear out for that term. So my guest today is Dr. Rebecca Johnson. She joined the Marine Corps War College as a Dean of Academics and Deputy Director in November 2015. She previously served on the faculty at the Command and Staff College from 2009 to 2015 and as the Chair of the University's Faculty Council from 2012-2016. It's pretty impressive, but I don't know what it is. Now, also, before becoming to the Marine Corps University, Dr. Johnson taught at the Georgetown Public Policy Institute at Georgetown University, and from 2004-2008 was an assistant professor in the School of International Service at the American University. From 2003-2005, Dr. Johnson served as the academic director for the South Carolina Washington Fellows Program at the University of South Carolina. Dr. Johnson's current research explores how to develop and maintain moral fitness. Her most recent publication, Serving Two Masters When Professional Ethics Collides with Personal Morality, appeared in George Lucas's Routledge Handbook of Military Ethics 2015, and it's not the George Lucas you're thinking of. Her chapter, Ethical Requirements of the Profession, Obligations of the Professional, the Profession, and the Client, will appear in Nate and Ty's book that is now available through our bookstore. That's, of course, Redefining the Modern Military. Now, Dr. Johnson holds a BA in Government from the University of Texas, and that's at Austin, an MA in Government from Georgetown University, and a PhD in Government also from Georgetown University, and interestingly, a Master's of Divinity from Wesley Theological Seminary. Rebecca, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm honored to join the Dead Prussian team.
I'm glad you feel honored. You should, because it's a very prestigious team. I don't know if everyone's aware that there's a saying out there that you haven't made it in international relations and national security spheres unless you've been on the show, but I'm sure it's a thing. Mostly I'm the one saying it, but it's okay. We'll see how we go. Now, Rebecca, before we start discussing the attributes of professionals and clients and I get really into some bad jokes, can you tell us a little bit about how you wound up starting off doing a BA in in Austin, and then all of a sudden you're at the Marine Corps War College.
Sure. So my undergraduate degree was on government, but it was in comparative politics. I focused on Russian political systems. And so when I started my PhD program, I had intended to continue that focus and moved into international relations and studied the transatlantic security relationship, wrote my PhD on multilateral peacekeeping in the Balkans, and graduated with my PhD in 2003, just a couple of months after we had invaded Iraq. Mm. And I was a research fellow at the Brookings Institution at the time. And I was just struck by this feeling of futility that we would sit around different tables in DC or London, Paris, Berlin, wherever. And so we would eat different cookies, but we would have the exact same conversations about the transatlantic relationship and how the United States had messed things up and things were never going to get better. And I realized that I just couldn't spend the next 30 plus years doing that. And so I thought about where I thought I could make a more significant contribution. And that was in the area of military ethics, that there were people doing good in this field already. But at that particular moment in our history, I really felt like we had an obligation to make morally sound decisions concerning where we send our troops to fight, which means where we're sending them to kill and die. And I felt that we had a profound obligation to make morally sound decisions concerning how we organize the armed forces, who gets in, what we do with them while we have them, what we do once you depart the armed forces and go back into civilian life. And I was incredibly fortunate to get a job teaching at the Command and Staff College at Marine Corps University, where I taught for 6.5 years. And just because you mentioned it, be chair of the faculty council is just a board of faculty members who make recommendations to university leadership on things related to faculty governance.
Oh, cool.
It was fun, but it was not, you know, super exciting.
Sounds amazing.
But so I taught at I taught at CSC for a little over 6 years before moving to the War College, or McWar, as we know ourselves, in 2015.
McWar, I like that. Kind of sounds like my first name.
Yep.
Now, our listeners have heard a little bit about the book that your chapter that we're discussing is in. Hopefully I've convinced them to purchase a copy or even 7, particularly through our bookshelf, so that Nate and Ty don't get to hog all the massive profits I'm sure they're making on this book. Now, your chapter itself addresses the attributes and obligations required of a profession, the professional, and the client. Perhaps maybe you could start by telling us why attributes are a useful angle to examine professionalism from.
Sure. So the book itself as a whole broadly looks at the relationship between the profession of arms and ethics. And for me, I've been struck for a long time that when we talk about military professionals, particularly if we're talking in the context of the civil-military relationship, we tend to focus on what the professional owes, that they're expected to remain non-political, they're expected to sacrifice their life, they're expected to remain obedient to all lawful orders, even patently stupid ones. But we don't spend much time focused on what the professional is owed. That professions exist in relationship with the clients they serve, and so any ethical requirements of the profession of arms has to be examined relationally, and so that's what I undertook to do in the chapter. That I look at the ethical requirements of the profession itself, so the attributes of the profession, the expertise, the rules and values that define the standards of the profession, in this particular instance, the profession of arms. I also examine the ethical requirements of the professional, so the skills, leadership, character traits that are needed in those responsible for maintaining the standards of the profession.
Yeah.
But then finally, and importantly, the client itself has ethical requirements, the guidance, the support, the values they need to demonstrate to enable the profession and its members to set and uphold those standards, to do that job for them.
I mean, it makes sense now that you've explained it. It also made sense to me because I read the chapter, listeners. So, you know, I'm being a bit sneaky here. But I guess the best way we can cover it off for the listeners, and you know, this is kind of how it's approached in the book. What I do love, listeners, about this chapter is there's actually tables that you can actually refer to, which is good. I think also for you, Rebecca, it's a sign that you've been teaching at military colleges for a while because they do love a good table. I'm sure the artillerymen in your classes absolutely love it because it looks like firing tables. But basically, let's start with the attributes of a profession. You know, what are they and why are they important?
I can't claim ownership of these, so they come from a white paper that the Army produced back in 2010. but they made really good sense to me. And so I built on them for this chapter. And I agree with you on tables. I think it's important, particularly if you're talking about complex things, not just tables, but graphics, image. If you're talking about something that's complex, the more you can do to help people key in on the essential features, the better, right?
Yeah.
So the Army gives us five attributes of a profession, and for them, the profession of arms. And the first attribute is expertise, that the profession has an expectation to maintain a high level of specialized expertise. So if we're talking about the profession of arms, it's the expert use of violence for a political end. And if you don't have that expertise, you're not a profession, you're not a military.
Yeah.
The second attribute or requirement is service. So the expertise, the expert use of violence for political end, that expertise is used on behalf of a client. And for us in the United States, technically it's the Constitution. Service members and all federal officials take an oath of office, and that oath is to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. But it's hard to personify that in a meaningful sense. And so we tend to think of the client as the American people.
Yeah.
Because that's a lot easier than a piece of paper.
Yeah.
So people join the military to serve. You know, in the U.S., we even talk about the military as the service, right? You're a member of the service or you're a service member.
Yeah.
And so this commitment to service, I think, is most obviously seen in what is called the military's unlimited liability, that the military accepts that its members might die or be seriously wounded in combat. And so as a profession, the military sacrifices its own members, sometimes in shockingly large numbers and against its own better judgment, in service to the client. And that commitment to service is a powerfully strong bond. And so it's one of those essential defining elements of any profession, but particularly the profession of arms, because that service comes with the cost of life. And so the third attribute is tied to this, and that's trust. The client trusts the profession to use its expertise on their behalf. They trust the profession to self-regulate, so to set the standards for who gets to join, and to have self-regulating processes like the Uniform Code of Military Justice, non-judicial punishment, courts martial, to help police the force. That the service itself determines who stays in and who gets out, for what reasons. And then the fourth criteria of the profession is a commitment to development. In order to maintain that expertise of lethal force in pursuit of a political end, the profession has to remain laser focused on improvement. And we see this in credentialing requirements across the different services, as well as continued development, commitment to development over time, so very strict promotion and command requirements, as well as an institutional commitment to innovation. And so we see this tactically, doctrinally, and in tech. You had August Cole talk a few podcasts ago about the use of fiction, and this was coming from the Marine Corps and the Army's desire to look into the future to get an idea of what trajectories we might be going down so they can be prepared for it. That's an illustration of this commitment to development.
Okay.
And then the final attribute would be values, and it's a bit squishier, but it's fundamental. To ensure the profession remains focused on its client, that it's not just good at killing, but it's only killing for a very particular purpose. This development of expertise has to be tied to foundational values that benefit the client. And so I'll speak for the Marine Corps values because they're the ones I know the best. They're tied. The Marine Corps and the Navy in the United States share the same values, and they're honor, courage, and commitment.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask any American about honor, courage, and commitment, they're going to say, yes, amen, you know, table slap. That is part of what it means to be an American. Those are American values.
Yeah.
And so as the Marine Corps thinks about what should we be doing in any particular, or a Marine thinks about what should I be doing in any particular moment, it orients their thinking around those values. They're tied without any question, tied to the client. Not just the Constitution, but the American people and what it means to be American.
Hmm. It's I'm just going to applaud you for that excellent mention of a previous episode and previous guest. I just want all guests in future to note that, and likewise help me with my downloads. But I'm going to do probably the clumsiest segue for the easiest setup ever. So we talk about, you know, what are the attributes of the profession, and I guess, you know, reading through your chapter, I was like, well, surely they must be the same for the professional, but they're slightly different from your chapter. So Maybe we should discuss the attributes of a professional as distinct from the actual profession itself. How are they different? Now, I know that some are different, but also know that some are linked and they kind of overlap. So how are they different? How are they linked? How do they overlap?
Mm-hmm. So if the profession is the organization, so it is the military, not even the Marine Corps, it's the military, the profession of arms, then the professionals are the individual people who make up this bigger whole. And so their responsibilities are personal responsibilities, whereas the profession's responsibilities are corporate. And so there are individual professionals, if they rise in rank to a certain level of seniority, let's say a sergeant major or a general officer, who still maintain their personal obligations as professionals, but really they are stewards of the profession at that point. And so they're making organizational decisions that shape the profession overall, right? That identify who can come into the force, what are the standards to stay within the force, how are we communicating with Congress, what are the things we're doing as an organization to maintain trust with the American people. So I think it's a level of scale, maybe would be the easiest way to think about the difference between the profession and the professional. Although again, those people who really are making decisions to shape the profession, they still have their personal obligations as professionals. And the first of those obligations is skill. So if the profession is expertise, like corporate knowledge, the individual's obligation is to maintain and develop their skill. And that can be tactical skills, it can be operational, it can be strategic decision making. A fundamental skill would be judgment. So knowing when to follow the rules, when the rules shouldn't apply because the situation is sufficiently different, how to innovate, how to handle complex or murky situations. Fundamental responsibility of the professional is to develop that skill and continue to cultivate it over the course of their time in service.
Mm.
Trust is the same. So the profession maintains a trust relationship with the client. So do individual service members. And so we think of things like Abu Ghraib in the United States or sexual assault as a challenge in the United States military. We see those things as undermining our trust that the profession writ large has with the American people. And we see Congress responding to that violation of trust on the individuals violating the trust, that being seen as a corporate or profession violating the trust, and Congress, who regulates the military in the United States, responding with efforts to limit the military's autonomy to self-regulate. And so there were discussions here, it comes up from time to time, that Congress is discussing whether or not to remove UCMJ authority, so prosecution authority, in cases of sexual assault. Typically, the commander of that unit would have the ability to prosecute for sexual assault. But the argument coming out of certain members of Congress today is that commanders have not shown themselves responsible in holding service members to account for sexual assault. And so it should move outside of the military, that prosecution should happen in civilian court.
Hmm.
Some people say that this is political grandstanding. Maybe it is. I can't see into the hearts of members of Congress. But it's rooted in this idea fundamentally that military professionals have broken faith with the American people. They have violated the values they were supposed to uphold, and there are consequences for that, and that consequence is loss of autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
So the third requirement of the professional is that professionals have an ethical responsibility to develop those junior to them.
Mm-hmm.
So the institution writ large has the same commitment to develop, to continue to develop tactically, doctrinally, to innovate. Individuals have that same responsibility on a personal level, but particularly, unless you are the most buck private junior person in your organization, you are leading someone. And so this idea of leadership is that you're not only going to develop yourself, you're going to develop those subordinate to you. And the challenge today, particularly over the last 15, 16 years, is finding space for this development. That we've been so focused on the mission, the deployment cycles have been so crazy up until just a couple years ago, that there hasn't been, other than kind of on-the-job training, right, there hasn't been a lot of focus and a lot of white space to really develop junior service members professionally.
Mm.
The fourth requirement is character. You know, we talk about values of the profession, but we talk about individual character. And so I mentioned values when discussing this concept of trust. and how that has been violated in certain situations from time to time. But this trust violation is significant precisely because it demonstrates a character weakness in the professionals who are responsible for that violation of trust. So a soldier who ignores American values in the pursuit of lethality, that person might be incredibly effective as a killer, but they're not professionally able to serve the client because they're not upholding the values that maintain the relationship with the client.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final attribute of professional, the idea of duty. For the service goal, it's the commitment of service, right? But for the individual, it's an obligation that we think of as duty, that professionals have an ethical responsibility to honor their duty to the client. And yeah. So they are duty-bound to follow all lawful orders, to go where the service tells them to go, when the service tells them to go, even if that means missing birthdays or Christmas or the birth of a child or the death of a parent. That this is where we get the idea of sacrifice, that remaining duty-bound is hard for the professional. I mean, it might be hard for the service as a whole, but where the rubber hits the road or in the individual decisions of actual soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and it's hard. And so we value their commitment to duty, but it is a core feature of the individual professional because that's the sacrifice they have to make repeatedly over a career in service.
And we move to the next one, which is interesting because the profession and the professional, you've used the U.S. Army manual. Let me have a look what it was. It was the U.S. Army white paper on the profession and the professional. But the client, from what I read in your article, these are the attributes that you've developed as your argument in the chapter. So the third category, for those listeners that weren't listening or just ignore me during my own show, thanks very much. The third person is the client or group of individuals as a client. Now, we're talking military. We talked about it before. We're not going to suggest that the client for the military is the enemy because it's a short-lived relationship. But the client in this instance is the community or the nation that military serves on behalf of. Now, this might be a new concept to some of our listeners in terms of understanding how that fits in to the idea of professionalism. So can you talk about the client's attributes and why, what they are and why they're important in terms of understanding the modern military profession?
Sure. And this really was, for me, the most interesting part of the chapter because there's significantly less written on this than on the responsibilities of the profession or the attributes of the profession or the professional. And again, this is what drew me to this project was the idea that the military serves something other than itself, right? It lives in a service relationship. It is duty bound to maintain that service relationship. And so we ought to be thinking about the responsibilities of the other end of that relationship, which is the client, the American. And so while the profession is responsible for setting its own stance, and the professional is responsible for maintaining those standards in themselves and in those they lead, the client is responsible for maintaining both the profession and its members to fulfill those responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And so the client relationship is one of an enabling role because they're not the ones executing. They're just the ones kind of setting the conditions for the profession and the professionals to go and execute. And so the first of these criteria that I look at is political guidance. And I argue that the client has an ethical responsibility to provide sufficient political guidance to direct and constrain the profession's work. And so the client, and this wouldn't be the American people, this would be the president or Congress, they articulate a political end. And they also articulate, and this is critical, they articulate expectations concerning what success looks like. What does it mean to have met that end? And then the military goes and they exert violence in order to achieve that military end. But if you don't articulate the end, and if you don't articulate what success looks like, then the military can go fight for decades. They can go do great things tactically and strategically, but if they don't know what the end is, they don't know where they're going, right? They're fighting without, and that I'm going to argue that's not okay. That's a violation of the relationship.
Mm.
So the second criteria is trust. And so this trust right here, that is a constant across all three elements of this relationship, the profession, the professional. So just the profession and the professional must maintain trust with the client and in the context of how I think about this with the American people, so must the American people maintain trust with the profession and its members. Service members have to be able to trust that they won't be sent to fight foolish wars. They'll go do it, right? The client can tell them to go do stupid and they'll go do it. But they ought to be able to trust that they won't be sent to do something stupid. They trust the American people will provide sufficient resources to enable them to achieve whatever that stated end that was articulated, whatever the political guidance was. And if that trust is violated, then again, that doesn't mean that the profession or its members will fail to maintain their relationship, but it means that the relationship is damaged. And so the third requirement or the third attribute is that actual tangible support. So this is tied to trust.
Mm-hmm.
It's necessary to actually provide material support in that desired end state. Because just think about it. Let's say that the political alliance is given, that this is the end state that we want to achieve as the United States or Australia. This is what success looks like.
Yeah.
But we're not going to actually resource you. We're setting you up to fail. We're not actually to achieve the end.
Yeah.
That's just not okay. I mean, that's just a fundamental violation. You're going to send other people to fight and die, to kill. You know, let's not, we think of soldiers losing their lives. But it is a morally significant thing to take life as well. So you're going to send people to kill and be killed knowing that you haven't resourced them to achieve victory. That you're literally sending them into that situation to fail. That's, in my opinion, morally abhorrent.
Mm-hmm.
It's from our values. And we see this stream of values underlying all three elements of relationship. If we expect the person of learned and to uphold core values, then the client's got to be clear about articulating what the values are. And we see instances of this in the United States context. Congress did this when it voted for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell to allow homosexuals to serve openly in the military. What Congress was saying was, prior to this time, Congress had passed, it was law that said that homosexuals couldn't serve openly, but certainly the culture within the military supported the law. And so Congress ultimately came a few years ago and said, "List of chance, no reason why you can't be gay and also be an effective warfighter. Services figure." There was more drama than some people had anticipated. On the other end, and a more example for me, an ethicist, roughly half of Americans don't have a moral problem with torture. They think torture is acceptable. And so that sends a message to our church. I mean, it's literally, it's 49-48% on each side and then a couple of percentage points of Americans who don't know where they don't have an opinion on. So this sends a message to the troops that torture could be okay, even though it's considered a war crime under international law. So the values espoused by the client in this particular case in the United States context opens professionals up to great risk. And so this idea of core values that are clearly articulated by set them up for success, critical.
That's interesting, those values. And you talked about it a bit when you talked about support, but what really got me was that commitment value that the client has. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so here I just talk about that in terms of support, that you can't just abandon the troops in because it's expedient, you know, and here we might think things like continued material resources to continue the fight. We also might think of aftercare. And so another way to think of commitment, and again, I don't know what it's like in Australia, but in the United States, there's some challenges with transition of troops coming back, getting out of service and becoming civilians again. And maybe they have some lingering mental health challenges from what they've seen in combat. Maybe they have some problems finding a job because of the general job market matching up with their particular skill sets, what they did when they were in the military. But here the commitment would be, I articulate that the client, the American people, have an obligation to returning service members to make sure that they're able to reintegrate back into society in a way that is meaningful and effective. Because again, we're expecting great sacrifice of service members. And that sacrifice doesn't just flip off like a switch as soon as someone ends their service and either retires or just separates and becomes a civilian. Those costs are still present in that person, and so the client's obligation continues as well.
Yeah, I found that a pretty interesting value when you wrote about it in the chapter, and you know, we still have some way to go here in Australia, but there's a fair amount of effort being thrown behind transition, both from the institutions responsible and also from the non-profit sector. And I encourage listeners to get behind Soldier On Australia, which is one of the not-for-profits that's out there helping that transition. Now, Rebecca, we could sit here and discuss each of these attributes a little bit more in detail. Some of them seems like an absolute hornet's nest, and we're not going to talk about the torture statistics. I wasn't aware of those, and that's quite alarming, actually. But we have to get to the final question that every guest has on the show. Now, every guest gets the same final question because it relates to our mission on the show, which is to define war in as many ways possible, just like, you know, Big Carl, the dead Prussian himself did, a dead Prussian who's actually quoted in your chapter. I noticed the footnote there. So you must be very well prepared for this question. I ask each guest the same question, as I said, and that question is to finish a sentence. So I ask you now, can you finish the sentence, war is?
So I spent a lot of time thinking about this. And I'm going to say that war is a contest of wills and resources.
Hmm.
And that is a bad dictionary definition because it's not exhaustive, right? There are plenty of other things that are also a contest of wills and resources.
Yeah.
But when I think about who wins a war, it's the side that refuses to give up. And yep. It's the side that doesn't run out of schlitz, right?
Yeah.
That's an American phrase. I don't know if that translates in Australian.
We're just going to say stuff.
Okay. It's not very often that a war, and I'm not talking about a battle or an engagement or a campaign, but a war.
Yeah.
It's not very often that a war is won on the battlefield where one side kind of outfights the other. You know, I can think of the Six Days War. I can think of the First Gulf War. But most of the time, that's just not how it happens. Most of the time, one side gets sick of fighting or they've got other priorities that kind of take precedent over the war. Or they simply run out of gas. They got nothing left. They got no more people. They got no more guns. And so if you want to figure out which side is going to win, I mean, it comes down to who wants it more and who's got more people and more stuff to throw at the fight.
Mm.
So again, I mean, that's
it's interesting.
That's not going to get me to dictionary.com, but that's how I think about it.
It'll get you an interview on the show. So that's good enough. And you know, I've never heard of Schlitz before, but I'm going to try and use it in the next brief I write. Rebecca, thanks very much for coming on the show. I know it's first thing Monday morning. A few there, and I suppose it's actually quite a pleasant way to start the week talking with me, so that's okay. But thanks very much for coming on the show.
I love it. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now, listeners, if you enjoyed that interview, and you know what, even if you didn't, go out and buy the book. The book is Redefining the Modern Military. It's edited by Nathan Finney and Tyrell Mayfield. That's right. I use their full names. So I'll be surprised. You can find it in the show notes through our bookshelf. You find it on Amazon, Book Depository, anywhere you can jump on a computer and find Google. You can find this book. In fact, there's Google for phones now, I've heard. You can also support Rebecca by finding her on Twitter and joining in the conversation. And she is at Johnson R, and that is JohnsonR. Also, listeners, thanks very much for all your support with the charity run I did recently, and those listeners who donated money towards Soldier on Australia and the transition work they do for Australian veterans. Thanks very much. It was quite a jog. I'm not sure if I set a land speed record or even my own land speed record, but I did have fun doing it. And finally, to our Patreon legends, thank you very much for your support. We have more bonus content coming out for you. And finally, until next time, listeners, grab a book and crack on.
Join the conversation with us on Twitter at Dead Prussian Pod, on Facebook at The Dead Prussian Page, or on our website, www.thedeadprussian.com. All show notes for this episode, as well as copyright information, can be found on the website. The Dead Prussian Podcast is written, produced and hosted by Mick Cook. It is co-produced by Amanda Levito. The music used throughout is Caught in the Beat by Broke for Free and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. All opinions expressed by individuals on the podcast are those of the individual and not necessarily representative of any other organisation.